Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 201, Tibet's Wisdom Tradition.
Then the secret biography, it's like, really, you know, I was going to say this, it's like, you know, the great Siddhas are like Jedi in the sense that they don't die. And they do leave their meat space body, as John Perry Barlow calls it, or Ram Dass calls it, meat puppet. They leave the meat puppet at a normal time, pretty much. But then they're always there in this light type of body. And because they are a kind of Buddha, and they can appear to people centuries later, it doesn't matter. And everybody showed up during this five-year retreat, and it's all listed in the secret biography. And different ones told him different things, but very importantly, one of the most important things that's very significant, really, for a student of Tibetan history, is Maitreya appeared to him, the future Buddha, a lot, and told him he had to really get things going, etc., and gave him a lot of backing. And you probably don't know that, but in Chinese history, the Chinese different imperiums get really nervous about whenever Maitreya shows up, because Maitreya is the next Buddha. And even though in the Buddhist cosmology, sort of Kali Yuga going down and up history, it could be thousands of years before Maitreya comes back as a perfect Buddha. Nevertheless, when people start orienting toward the future, they're not content with things getting worse and worse. They want progress, you know, they want action from the government. They want justice, you know what I mean? So revolutionary movements tend to focus around Maitreya, is what I'm saying. And Maitreya is totally, totally sponsoring the Tsongkhapa movement, totally. And, I just saw something today in the secret thing that I had forgotten. He had a vision of Maitreya when he was seven, actually, probably when he had that Yamantaka initiation. Atisha. He had a vision of Atisha. So he always felt kind of connected to Atisha also, you know, who started the second dissemination. So he met all of them, and he met all the different Yidams, you know, and he met Buddha as Kalachakra, who predicted that he would do this and do that. So he did. So it was an amazing long retreat, is what I'm saying. And at the end of the retreat, he and his friends, they went just north of the Olkha Cholong where they were. And I've been there to a place called Xingji. And there's a small temple in Xingji. It may not have been as small then as it is now, but it's small. And but in it, there was a famous Maitreya statue, which used to talk to people, although there's no record that it talked to Buddha, to Tsongkhapa, the statue. I mean, he saw Maitreya. He had visions of Maitreya, who he met. He encountered Maitreya, but not in the statue. But anyway, they got all upset that it was fallen on hard times. And they did some pujas to wealth deities, and then a bunch of nomads showed up with gold, gave them funds to hire artists, and then a bunch of artists showed up. It was all very auspicious. And they made a big, long Maitreya festival at Xingji. And then during that time, it's like, you know, modern scholars get all upset about this sort of thing. They call it hagiography, and it couldn't possibly be true, and all this kind of thing. But people all over that part of central Tibet were seeing visions all the time in the sky, just ordinary people, not just psychics. And it was like a super magical time. And they saw all these miracles and these. I personally think we don't really have enough evidence to be sure of this, but I personally feel that from this time, the seeing of vast visions in the sky started becoming kind of a fashion. Because the movement was so charismatic and so many people were having breakthroughs in their mind that nowadays, you know, you have those thangkas in Tibetan communities that are like the whole side of a mountain, you know, like huge thing that's like 100 yards big and this kind of thing. That there doesn't seem to be records of that existing before this 15th century time. And so I think that those huge thangkas emerged from these kind of charismatic experiences that happened. Not only the ones by Tsongkhapa, there were other ones as well, but there were a lot of this kind of experience going on. And so much so that that a famous Nyingma / Kadam guy called Lojak Kenshin Namka Gyantsen, he saw these things in the sky and he realized, oh, there's a big, big implosion going on over in Xingji. And he came over, he was elderly, he sent a messenger over and then invited Tsongkhapa and his friends to come over, which they were, because they were finished their retreat, so they went over. And then when His Holiness the Dalai Lama's senior tutor used to hear his name, Lhotak Kenshin, he would go like this. Oh, he's in such a debt of gratitude, he would say. Because Tsongkhapa and the eight guys, they were so gung-ho about, and they were having visions of Shakyamuni too all the time. They wanted to go to India, to Bodh Gaya, and they wanted to go do pilgrimage in India. But at that time in India, around 1400, there were just Muslims there, and there was nothing going on in Bodh Gaya. And they would get sick. And as Lhotak Kenshin said, don't do that. And Lhotak Kenshin was famous because when he gave teachings to people, they saw him as Vajrapani. He would turn into Vajrapani, turn blue and growl, and then teach them, and they would take it really seriously. So, and when Tsongkhapa took teachings from him, which he did, he saw him as Vajrapani, and then he asked Tsongkhapa for teachings, and Tsongkhapa, he would see Tsongkhapa as Manjushri, they say. Tsongkhapa would turn into Manjushri to teach him. So they had an amazing thing. But the great thing he did as far as Ling Rinpoche went, their previous life, was he dissuaded them from this trip to India. He said, you must stay here. You have a lot to do for Tibet. And it's much more important for the Dharma and for the future than just going to India because of your, you know, you're all jacked up on faith. So don't go there. So then they agreed with that and they stayed. And then their later lamas who know the whole story are very grateful to Lhotak Kenshin. And he's reincarnated as someone called the Lelung Rinpoche. There's an incarnation tradition of that person who lives in England nowadays. So that's the first. That's called the first of the four great deeds of Tsongkhapa during these 21 years from his enlightenment, is the renovation of the Maitreya Temple and the Maitreya Festival, and his meeting with the Lhotak Kenshin, and deciding to stay in Tibet, you know, and work for the people in Tibet. And then the second one, then he goes to central Tibet a lot, and then he becomes known, well known by the Pagmo Druma hierarchs and their Kagyu Lamas called the Chenga Rinpoches, who become very fond of him. There's an older one who passes away fairly soon in his movement, and then the younger one is practically his student. And then he gets them to organize, and he calls everybody, Sakyas, Kagyus, and whatever Kadampas or anybody who's around. And they have a big Vinaya in 1402, a couple of years later. They organize a big Vinaya assembly with the sponsorship of the Pagmo Drumas. And everybody gets more gung-ho about no more beer, strict celibacy, good scholarship, whichever sect or order you're in, doesn't matter. And so there was a big revival of the monastic practice and also thousands of people wanting to become monastics, because getting inspired to use their human life in a valuable way for themselves in an evolutionary sense, and therefore needing more monasteries. And these aristocrats would be generously building them and feeding them and supporting them. So it was a really great movement, but especially he could say that's a second great deed. And then over the next 6 or 7 years, he travels here and there giving huge teachings, and one doesn't know what kind of voice he might have had. It's like Occupy Wall Street, where somebody says something and then everybody repeats it, rippling out. They didn't have audio, equipment, you know, because they describe assemblies of thousands of people receiving teachings. And one always wonders how they. Actually, the young Dalai Lama, if any of you ever heard him teach when he was younger, he has the booming voice, incredible voice that just goes everywhere. Even nowadays, he has a mic, but in the old days, you could practically hear it anyway. So maybe they had extraordinary voices, or he did. I don't know. They say he had a Brahma voice. That's a god voice, you know. So, but then he was being urged by all of them to build a monastery of his own, which he didn't want to do because he thought of himself as following the Kadampas. And actually had a big inspiration in Radeng, which had been the home seat of the Kadampas after Atisha, founded by Dromdomba in north of Lhasa, now near one lake up there. And that's where he spent time writing Lam Rim Chemo and constantly seeing, he was like talking to Atisha all the time. And in scholarship, his whole thing was there's two main things that he did, I think you can say. He really hit the non-duality thing powerfully. And Manjushri had told him that his special mission was to intensify attention on the relative reality, actually. Not just get carried away in emptiness, let's go. Of course, there's the real direct coexistence of emptiness, he certainly had. But that's not complicated, although it takes an effort to achieve it. To get your visceral achievement of selflessness or emptiness, of course, is huge. But it's not complex in a way, in the same way. What is complex is how to use the relative reality to help others learn that, or even use it to learn it yourself. So therefore, reasoning, you know, the final union of reasoning with transcendentalism, you know, that reason is critical to realizing emptiness, in fact, and inference is critical to the non-conceptual. So the accurate conceptual understanding of the philosophy of emptiness is critical to developing the non-conceptual one-pointed union of shamatha and vipassana and realizing emptiness. So he was really radical about that. And part of that radicality had to do with the fact that space like equipoise samadhi, I don't know how much you all have studied of all this, but some of you have, I'm sure. You know that the way you look for emptiness, the way you study emptiness is you don't think about some emptiness. You look at how full you think things are. You know, you don't think about selflessness, you look for yourself. And it's only the not finding of a self that fits the definition of what a intrinsically real self would be, or the not finding of an object that fits the definition of what a non-empty object, an object based in its own intrinsic substance, and therefore not empty of some essence that's really the object. The not finding of those things are where you then come to experience of emptiness. You become experience of the self. And in the early stages of that experience, you have what's called a space-like equipoised samadhi, where in a way you disappear. And they make a big fuss about warning you. All the Indian texts and Tibetans are even better than the Indian texts about that. And they warn you that when you have this space-like, where you disappear into this sort of space-like state, that's not the ultimate, that's not the absolute reality. Because emptiness is also empty. So when you're looking for the thing and you fail to find it, it seems that it's empty. But then you say, well, but what is this emptiness? You don't say it at that point because you're not thinking in words at that point. But you have a momentum of analysis, of vipassana, of lakdong in Tibetan, of penetrating insight. And that momentum of penetrating insight carries you into, well, what is this empty space I'm in? Is it up? Is there up, down, east, west, north, south, from former moment or later moment, the moment when I first got into it and some later time after it? You know, in other words, your mind starts penetrating the state of feeling free. If you can, and avoiding being trapped in thinking, oh, this is emptiness. Because remember, matter is emptiness. It doesn't say emptiness is emptiness. It says matter is emptiness, and emptiness is matter. And emptiness is empty, actually. Emptiness is not emptiness, but emptiness is empty of being emptiness itself. So the Tsongkhapa really got that well. And on the morning of his enlightenment in 1398, he wrote that wonderful Tendritapa, I call it Praise for Relativity, praising of Shakyamuni Buddha for his teaching of relativity. Dendel, he calls it, which means relativity. You can say dependent origination, but for Madhyamakas, it's non-origination, so that's not really a good thing to say, to translate it that way. It's really relativity, dependently connecting, literally, Dendel. And so he was all wowed out by the fact that emptiness is all of these relative things. And that's where compassion comes in, you see. If you think the ultimate goal is to space out somewhere, and you mistakenly think that's emptiness, and now I'm an absolute, and of course you won't stay there anyway, because you will come back, but then when you come back, people who think that was the moment where I realized absolute, then they go around thinking they're enlightened, and then in Zen they say they're trapped in the demon ghost cave. Because they think they're superior to other people because they had an experience of disappearing. I'd like to tease people like that. I know a few. I like to tease them. I say, well, if you're enlightened just by disappearing, everybody on the planet is enlightened since they fall asleep every night and they disappear into the pillow. So that's not that. And Tsongkhapa was really clear about it, because that's where wisdom becomes compassion. When the space-like thing is just the failure to find core non-relative essences in things, including yourself, then the things relatively are still there. And the emptiness is their interactive presence. And then pain becomes unnecessary, and pain becomes unbearable. And others' pain becomes unbearable because you feel one with them. You have eradicated a sense of absolute boundary between yourself. There is still relative boundary, but your empathy expands and your ability to identify with others expands enormously. Up to Buddhahood, where you think you're everybody. Poor guy. Right? Did you ever have that experience? Instead of sitting there looking out of your face at other things, you suddenly felt you were the people you were looking at as well? Oh, what happened? I got stoned. You might have been frightened if you ever had that. But you have had that experience. If you had a child, you looked at that face, you flipped out for a second before you caught yourself and reorganized into me and it, or me and he, or me and she. Maybe in love sometimes. Maybe identifying with your teammates, maybe whatever, you know. Human being has this amazing ability to identify with others, which is the root of compassion, of great compassion. And that's what Tsongkhapa was really strong about that. And so that was his real breakthrough thing, was that. And then in that context, then, fixing the world, fixing the conventional, fixing the illusory level of reality. It's illusory, but still it's important, and people can use the illusion to become free of illusion, to become realistic, which is what Buddhist education is all about. And I call it education, not training. Training is the thing that I failed to do to our household dogs. Education is what we do to human beings, you know, which means bringing out their own wisdom from themselves, not just indoctrinating them.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to a special episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. Over the past 4 years, Professor Thurman has brought you over 230 podcast episodes drawn from his live teachings in New York City, Menla Retreat, and from his appearances around the globe. This week's episode is drawn from Professor Thurman's recent West Coast trip to San Francisco. We'll include details about that visit and the extended video teaching of this audio recording. Over the past year and a half, Professor Thurman's been sitting down with dear friends of his and people who inspire him to record a series of conversations called the Tibet House U.S. Conversations. stay tuned for special announcements about the new Tibet House US podcast and episodes within this weekly Bob Thurman podcast, which will feature those interviews. This episode of the Bob Thurman podcast was sponsored by Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa. To learn more about upcoming programs with Professor Thurman and friends at Menla Retreat, please visit menla.us. The Bob Thurman podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special invites to trips with Professor Thurman around the globe with geographic expeditions, please visit tibethouse.us. Trips in 2019 include Bhutan. As always, music for the Bob Thurman podcast is generously supplied by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with Bob and Gary Gock.
Education is what we do to human beings, you know, which means bringing out their own wisdom from themselves, not just indoctrinating them. So anyway, he refused to make a monastery, in other words, and sort of become sort of localized in that way, Zohaba did. And instead, what he did with all the funding and all the support and the offerings that he received, you know, and also, he did also receive support for many big assemblies. You know, when you give a two-week teaching or a one-month-long teaching, the students need to eat. So these aristocrats and these lords, they brought food and they biasly fed them because they were all enthused by the charisma. And then he decided he would make one big festival and make it a yearly festival. And in that he would celebrate the miracles worked by Shakyamuni in the travesty and late in life. And so he started the Munlam Chemo Festival in 1409, which celebrates the miracles in the Lunar New Year that the Buddhist Sutra says Shakyamuni performed toward late in life. In dealing with sort of rival teachers and teachings and things, he performed for 15 days of miracles. I really like those miracles. It's, you know, there's a wonderful book, a wonderful translation in a book called Path, Door of Liberation, that my original root teacher did translated, called translation of a thing by the first Dalai Lama about that 2 weeks of miracles. He describes in a verse each of the miracles for the different kings of India, and it's really beautiful. So anyway, Tsongkhapa organized that in Lhasa, and in Lhasa he renovated for a year or two with the funding he received all the different temples in Lhasa, and the main Jokhang Cathedral and so forth. And then this is really important symbolically. He made of gold and jewels, you know, diamonds, rubies, coral, turquoise, and rose kind of gold. He made like a breastplate ornament, earrings, and crown for the Jo Buddha, you know, the central Buddha in Lhasa that the Tibetans feel is very special and magical. And it is an actual sculpture of Shakyamuni Buddha, they think, in their tradition. Some people, scholars don't think so, but they do. And which was a very innovative thing also because Buddha was a monk, so you don't put a crown. He stepped away from the throne. You don't put a crown on him and earrings and a big golden plate with jewels. But the reason he did it was he was doing it to commemorate and to teach the society the presence of Buddha as Obi-Wan, Jedi Master, Body of Light, present in the Sambhogakaya, since all he had, Shakyamuni had done was withdraw his emanation body and was present in his beatific body. So that's, those are the celestial deity, divinity ornaments that he gave, you know. And that's his, and that from that derives what I call the essence of Tibetan, you know, advanced Tibetan culture, which is millennial consciousness. And, you know, going back to the joke I made about the second coming, in other words, you know, the idea that Buddha's back or Buddha's here or Buddha never left, it isn't really quite a second coming, but it's, their second coming will be Maitreya in the future in a way, but of another Buddha. But this Buddha still didn't leave and is there and is all around you, and his energy and blessing is all there, and it's through the teachings, the speeches in the Dharma and the text. And if you learn them and you realize their meanings and put them into practice, then you it's just as good as if Shakyamuni was there and you were there back in Shakyamuni's time. This was the intensity of this millennial consciousness. You know, if you think about in Western eschatology or apocalypticism, if you think of, like, you know, they talk about the New Jerusalem, and then, well, what do people do once there is the New Jerusalem? Are they going to be nice? Are they still going to be Republicans and have the NRA and what? I don't think so. Then, you know, land of milk and honey, but then what are they going to do? Are they going to meditate? Are they going to meet God or the angels or what? You know, nobody considers that thing. But in a way, this in Tibet, this is the essence of why Tibet became so amazingly spiritualized, and why from this time there was this enormous acceleration of monastery building, so that by the 20th century you had over 6,000 monasteries and perhaps a fifth of the population being monastic, male and female monastic, or mendicant, basically. And because of the small population and the large step, or not such a big agricultural area, but a large step for sort of milk products and meat products, there was never any famine, and there was plenty of food. There was quite wealthy. Tibet was not poor, actually. That article in Time magazine, that paragraph in there about how miserable they were, is pure Chinese propaganda, that guy, Campbell. Otherwise, I like the picture. But other parts of his article were not so bad, but that one paragraph was really wrong, because except when some foreign army is there taking away the food, or it's a bunch of starving communists from Sichuan, or they're taking the food away, Tibet never had famines. You know, the rich and poor division was not that huge at all. And that's why they had to, they ended up, when they had to have in Eastern Tibet, you can read accounts, when they had to have quotas of class struggle and who are the oppressors and the landlords, they were taking basically farmers who were not that richer than anybody else, and then saying these are the bad landlords, and then you kind of sharecroppers have to come and beat them up. I mean, there wasn't big class division, in other words. It wasn't as huge. And then that guy talks about aristocrats, but there was like only like 120 aristocratic families, mostly living in Lhasa by that time, and absentee owning their land holdings. But it wasn't a big problem, actually. Anyway, he did Manlam Chemo, and then he started this millennial consciousness, basically. And then three huge monasteries were built right around Lhasa. The population of the monasteries more than the population of the town, if you get the kind of movement that was going on. And then the Dalai Lama started building them all over the place. And then finally, after that, all the patrons were so enthused by the Manlam Chemo festival that they gave more funding, and then they did build a monastery, started forming around his retreat place at Ganden. Even the name Ganden, by the way, is Tushita. That's the heavenly plane where Maitreya lives. So it shows the link with Maitreya, the name of his monastery. And so they did build that monastery, but he doesn't consider the building monastery one of his four great deeds. The fourth great deed was in the monastery about 5 years later, around 14, when he recovered from that near death that he had in 1413, he decided he was going to build three-dimensional mandalas of Guhyasamaja, Yamantaka, and Chakrasambhara. And they would have, and the main statues in them would be the size of like a five-year-old. So they must have been huge, and they were gilt bronze, made of gilded bronze. and a lot of artists collected. They were expensive, no doubt. And there were some funny stories about them, like when the casters finished casting some of the statues, the statue had a weird kind of rainbow-like tints in it, and they thought it was like chemical pollution or something, and they were polishing and polishing, and they couldn't get rid of it. And then they took it to Tsongkhapa and said, we can't like make it clear gold. It keeps shining these different like weird chemical colors. And he said, well, it's polishing itself. They're radiant. That's a good omen. Like, don't bother. You know that. Anyway, that's what his fourth grade did, building them, and he built a big hall for them because three-dimensional mandalas shouldn't be shown to people who would not know what it was, and they would think it was some weird thing. And those are totally destroyed, of course. Who knows where it happened to them? You know, it's really too bad. They must have been just amazing. And the name of the hall was Yangbajen, Vaishali in Sanskrit, which is the name of that city where Vimalakirti lived, where a lot of his tantras and where the medicine Buddha teaching was taught outside of Vaishali. So it's kind of very interesting, all these different omens. So that's about it. That's the main life of Tsongkhapa. I started with his total nirvana and the amazing visions that people had around him in that time. And then I worked through his being the Renaissance man and how his teaching still today, basically, they really are, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama in India, he goes around all the time nowadays, last 10 years, maybe 15, and he's saying, well, you know, you mustn't think of me as just the follower of some funny Tibetan sect of something called Tibetan Buddhism, although that's not wrong, but that's not really what I really am. What I really am is I'm a son of Nalanda, he says. And by that he means he's a product of his education, and his education is the great Buddhist monastic universities of India, which had a core curriculum that produced enlightenment. And then they also learned medicine and botany and art and literature and music, whatever other fields, the secular fields that they were there at the time, and their medicine was amazing. It still is there. The Ayurveda is still practiced. And I think Buddhism really was the thing that really expanded Ayurveda in India to the lower caste, for sure. Brahmins are not going to go, like, feel the pulse of some untouchables. Can't touch them, you know. And so that's for sure. That's a genuine thing. And so Tsongkhapa built all these big monasteries and the core curriculum of them with the great Indian masters, Dharmakirti, Chandrakirti, you know, Haribhadra, Vasubandhu, Asanga, all the great masters of Indian philosophy and spiritual practice are in the core curriculum of those Tibetan monasteries. So, you know, when the Indian government finally wakes up to it and they rebuild the monastery of Nalanda, the core curriculum will be the curriculum of Tsongkhapa's monasteries. They tried to do it without that. They tried to make one thinking Chinese would give them money if they didn't have anything to do with Dalai Lama, and that was just silly. And they fell apart, that effort, you know, by the Indians. You know, and they didn't make me run it. They gave it to some sociologist from Harvard. Although I love sociology, but that's silly. Core curriculum of a Nalanda, you don't just go build a Columbia University or a Harvard University in the dust in Bihar. The core curriculum has to be, you know, the spiritual curriculum of the great Buddhist monasteries. And then you can have modern secular subjects, of course, around that. But then it's because really what universities should do, which our universities don't, except indirectly, for the occasional rare teacher, you have to build the moral character and the insight and the enlightenment and overcome the racism and the sexism and the stupidity of our fellow Americans. That's what the core curriculum is supposed to be about. It's not just about, you know, preparing you to get a degree to go to Wall Street and become a master of the universe. Not really. How about it? Too much gets to be like that, but it shouldn't be like that. Okay, any questions? I think that's pretty much life of Tsongkhapa, don't you think? So his legacy is right there, these three nice monastics, mendicants. Did you all get bhikshuni vows, or did you go to Taiwan and get them? No? They still have it in the Mahasanghika lineage in Taiwan and South Korea. Yeah. They still have.
Yeah,
But not in Sri Lanka, doesn't have Burma, doesn't have Thailand, doesn't have. One of these days.
Maybe not my lifetime.
The next lifetime then. Maybe next lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, when you know, one thing that one of the legacies is, if you learn, you know, it's where you have to live a life with death on your shoulder.
Yeah.
And that makes you much more alive. And then you're not afraid of death. And then you know you're going to carry on with whatever you need to do and through death at some level or another, with depending on variant levels of control. You know, our medical one of the disasters of our medical system is the terror of death that people have. It's really stupid because they're going to die anyway, and it's very bad. As we know, it's really bad to go into a new space or meet your neighbor when you're feeling a state of terror. You're not very sociable, and so you're not likely to find a good neighborhood in the next life. You know, because you would see a jail as a safe place. So you'd go get born in an imprisoned type of place. So terror sucks. Any question? I'm sorry, I have to stop talking. Yes. Yes. You have to speak kind of loud because I'm really hard of hearing, and this very nice gentleman, our techie, he's our, what's your name, sir, the techie? What? Surge? Heard? Oh, okay. Okay, I'll get it later. Yeah, okay, what's the question, please? And speak into the mic.
I see. So my question is that we talk a lot about reincarnation. So basically, I think I was reading an article today about someone say that you can have a Buddhist theory, Buddhism without reincarnation, a belief in reincarnation. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think you can have anything you want. First thing. But second, reincarnation is not a theory or a sort of fantasy. And it's not reported by Buddha and all thousands and tens of thousands of Buddhist masters. It's not reported by them as a sort of mystical theory that does not have evidence, in other words, that you must believe. It's reported as an empirical fact that there is evidence for that can be discovered. And some people say that, and some lamas have in the past, like Trungpa Rinpoche. He tried to say that the Book of the Dead was just about psychological states. But that's because he's dealing with people who are secular and they're very resistant to this idea, and they think that reincarnation must be a blind faith thing. But it isn't, actually. There's a lot of evidence for it, a lot of people. You yourself can go to hundreds of therapists, probably in San Francisco. I know some in Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, who do very mild hypnosis, and you can have a past life regression, and you can remember the time when you were born in Kyoto, in a Zen center, or in Tiantai Mountain in China, or wherever, you know, or Wutaishan in Manjushri, Holy Land in China, and or in the wonderful monastery in Korea, and you can easily do that. And the main thing about that is, here's the main thing that finally I can announce to you after 40 years of thinking about it and arguing about it with people. Guess what the most blind faith belief in history is? Just guess. Do you think it's God? No. That's not as blind faith as the one I'm about to tell you about. The most blind faith is to believe that you can be nothing. Because nobody ever discovered nothing. Do you think? I always like to ask my natural science friends, which, was it Newton, was it Descartes? Who discovered nothing? Not only that, which guy got a Nobel Prize for nothing? And also, who is ever going to discover nothing? You guys are supposed to be only empirical evidence. You don't believe stuff by dogma. But actually, nobody has experienced nothing, and there's no evidence for the existence of nothing, because there is no such thing as nothing. That's what nothing means. Therefore, it's not a destination. There's no way you can be nothing. Because nothing can be nothing. Only, or rather you could say, only nothing can be nothing. Right? It is nothing. It can't really be it. Right? So that's total blind faith. So there is Buddhism without nothing, for sure. That's easy, because nothing is nothing you miss. Because you couldn't have it. Everything is without nothing, because there is no nothing. You get it? So therefore, always something is something else. So they have the law of conservation of energy, right? That energy is never destroyed. It only changes form. They have entropy. They're scared of it. Oh, entropy, that was really bad stuff. If you read Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now, you know, his rabid materialism, which is fun, kind of. I like it. I'm for Enlightenment Now. But basically, he transfers the feeling, the fear of hell that materialists are trying to escape from, to the fear of entropy. That's the bad, the dark side is entropy. But even entropy is not destroyed. It's just lurking in a formless state for a long time, kind of. Energy is. So that's one thing, you know. Then the second thing is, then they go on about, oh, how can a non-material thing relate to matter? That's the next big stumbling block for your natural scientists. And I've been talking with them for years. But then, you know what? I looked up in a book. You realize that energy is not matter. Therefore, E equals mc squared, right? Matter is one thing, and energy is another in Einstein, right? So energy is not matter. But they don't have a problem about energy affecting matter and matter converting to energy. You just have to get some high number, 186,000 mph squared, whatever that is. So that's the same problem. Mind is energy. And once energy is never destroyed, that means your mind is never destroyed. It can deteriorate. It can become diffuse. But then someday what is diffuse will come back together again, or it'll come together with other things. So the natural, intuitive, common sense thing is the continuity of subtle level of energy as well as coarse matter. That's a natural thing. And the people who because they're scared of hell, they're scared of future life, they even convince themselves that they're brave. Like, did you ever see the movie Pierrot le Fou? Pierrot the Madman? It was Jean-Paul Belmondo. And he was like a gangster, and he was like chasing French car chases, and, you know, with the mafia, and having coffee, drinking coffee and smoking gold bars and the whole thing. And very dashing, you know, existentialism, you know, Camus, you know. And then it ended up where he had a bunch of sticks of dynamite around his head, and he was smoking a cigar, and then he lit the fuse of the dynamite, and then the screen went white. And that's considered brave. What's brave about it? When a dentist is drilling Jean Belmondo's tooth or Camus' tooth, they're happy to be nothing, be unconscious. And they're very happy. Give me them, Novocaine. So what's scary is a future situation that you have no control, where you're driven by impulse, by random circumstance, and you have no control over that situation. That's what's scary. And that's why they bravely threw up a defense of I'm going to be nothing at death in the 17th century. And I commend them for it, because they were getting away from a bunch of really weird religious fanatics who were, like, you know, putting like concrete jock straps on them and like drilling them with, I don't know what, putting them in Iron Maidens and torture chambers, and really awful what the church was doing to people. So it was great. You can't scare us, because we just are not going to exist. That's a sense like calling for anesthesia in the dentist chair. It's a really smart thing. I'm all for it. But unrealistic? Certainly unrealistic. What do you think? And actually, Buddhism doesn't really have a meaning much without your long-term existence, because the evolutionary effort of becoming this kind of super being, which is what enlightenment is, it's not just something, a light bulb popping off in your head. It's becoming a being of complete competence in dealing with all kinds of difficulties of other beings and yourself, and being totally blissful in the midst of whatever it is, live or die, you know. It's a really extraordinary. And then this whole thing of the Nirmanakaya, do you know about that? the three bodies of Buddhahood and Nirmanakaya. It's like being 100 beings. If the people in the city need 100 beings, you can be 100. That's a really weird idea. You can be, your own consciousness can go into 100 beings. It's a very strange idea. And that's a meant idea in Buddhism. That they mean that. And it doesn't fit in materialists. I agree. But the materialists are the ones in the blind faith, the dogma of being nothing at death, which is no evidence for. Zero evidence. So they're transferring that fanaticism that the Inquisition used to have into their materialism. And that's ridiculous. That's just like the church was. So, you know, I know those people who do that about we don't need... Actually, I gave a talk before them in this city down at the docks there, you know, the in some big auditorium in the dock. A lot of people came. It was called Buddhism Without Buddhism. And it was going to be published by the Thich Nhat Hanh people. But then I kept saying that the way Buddhism will really help America and the West is offering the services, which is what Buddhism is constituted by, a bunch of services, how to educate yourself, how to control your emotion, how to do your be a bit better, be more ethical, blah, 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 you know, how to understand yourself and the world. These are kind of services, educational services, and not attaching the religious demand that you join the group, you know. That's the real way. Otherwise, that's why Dalai Lama, very carefully, and he really means it, he says he doesn't want to convert people to Buddhism. If they are already, he's happy to talk about Buddhism, and he likes Buddhism, but he says other people should keep their grandmother's religion, if possible, not to upset grandma. That's what, and he means it. He really does. I had a epiphany about it the other day, fairly recently, when I was thinking about Avalokiteshvara. Can you pronounce that? Avalokiteshvara. And I was thinking that Avalokiteshvara is like Jesus in the sense that he loves everybody. And therefore it's nice for people, the religious side of people, it's nice for people to feel that some higher power of some kind, not the creator is not really so good, because if it's an omnipotent creator, then people get pissed off at it, because why is it making me suffer, you know? It doesn't make sense to them. But if it's just that loves them, they feel really good about being loved. Do you have a girlfriend? They feel really good about it. Well, being loved just makes you feel good. People like it. You know, somebody else finally agrees that they're cool with themselves, right? So that's the case. So then, see, if people do really feel that Jesus loves them, why would Avalokiteshvara want them to switch to Avalokiteshvara so they could go around feeling loved by someone whose name they couldn't pronounce? So Dalai Lama is really sincere about it. And then when he does that, he looks at me and says, well, some people can't help themselves. They want to be Buddhists. It's legal. But it's better to learn things from the services, like meditation services, like philosophy services, like psychology services, ethical services. I did a talk once in an interreligious faith thing, interfaith thing. They were all mad at me, the people of the other religions, when I said that the founders of all of the religions were basically serving people around them. That's why the religions got founded. They were servants of the people, you know, helping them have a better life. But then when they become institutions, they get confused about that and they think they own the people. And then they fight each other for market share. And that's really a bad thing. That's not a good thing.
I'm Gary Gawk. And I'm reading a poem by a beat poet not often recognized as much as Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Diane DePrima, named Albert Saijo, who was born in Los Angeles, was interned during the war in a Japanese concentration camp, and later served in the army, then became a beatnik of sorts. He lived from 1926 to 2011, passing into the light from Volcano, Hawaii. Being familiar with Bob Thurman and his teachings, you may already know about the Bodhisattva vow. This is Albert Saijo's Bodhisattva Vows. Bodhisattva vows to be the last one off the sinking ship. You sign up and find out it's forever. Passenger list endless. Ship never empties. Ship keeps sinking, but doesn't go quite under. On board, angst, panic, and desperation hold sway. Turns out, Bodhisattvahood is a fucking job like any other, but different in that there's no weekends, holidays, vacations, no golden years of retirement. You're spending all your time and energy getting other people off the sinking ship into lifeboats, bound gaily for nirvana while there you are, sinking. And of course you had to go and give your life jacket away. So now let us be cheerful as we sink, our spirit ever buoyant as we sink. I'm Gary Gough, and this segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.